When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Bye, bye, baby. Bye, baby. I am bye, baby. I am bye, baby. I am bye, baby. I am bye, baby. I am.
Welcome to Brown Baby, a podcast about parenting and finding joy in bleak times. I'm your host, Nikesh Shukla. I'm the author of the newly released memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family and home. Guess what? It's in the shops right now. You can go and buy it. Please do support it. It's a memoir about raising kids and grieving for a parent and trying to muddle my way through difficult questions like how to talk to my kid about skin colour. I won't big it up. I'll let Deborah Frances White, host of The Guilty Feminist, do that for me. She said, Brown Baby is fizzing with humanity, life and light. Nikesh Shukla, that's me, has written page after page of golden prose that made me laugh out loud and weep real tears. Love, family, grief, race and gender are all nurtured carefully with intention and hope in this urgently relevant 21st century memoir. Thanks, Deborah. So in this podcast each week, I interview a different person about raising kids. I speak to actors, comedians, writers, journalists about raising kids, the reality of parenting and finding joy in bleak times. Bleak times. This week, my guest is the award-winning writer Kit Duvall. She is the author of two novels, My Name is Leon and The Trick to Time, the short story collection supporting cast, and editor of the anthology Common People. She is an absolute hero. I'm a huge fan of her work. In this episode, we talk about being mixed race, raising mixed race kids, adopting children, writing late at night, and how she is changing the publishing industry. Links to her books and mine are in the show notes. Please enjoy the interview. But first, a quick story. This week, my kid lost her first tooth. Nothing remarkable, except it was the talk of the town. There she was, eating an apple one minute, the next she was recoiling in pain, and then she discovered, to her absolute delight, she had a wobbly tooth. Suddenly the world became dwarfed by this tooth. Before long, she had shared the wobbly tooth news with our relatives. She had established a network of other kids in her class with wobbly teeth. She speculated about the motivations of the tooth fairy, and she wobbled it idly while watching television. What was remarkable about the whole thing was I just gave in to her world and let myself be spirited away by the whole thing. It was enthralling to obsess about something other than work and the news for a bit, and it gave me the necessary motivation to be a great tooth fairy. Except when it came to removing the tooth, when the time came, it was so tiny, it took me 7 minutes to locate it under her pillow, and she stirred 3 times. She didn't realise it was me, but the next day she noted that her worry doll had changed position under her pillow, wondering whether it had played with the tooth fairy. And I was along for the ride. It was amazing. I loved caring about something else. The only thing is, the fuck do I do with this tooth? It's tiny, easily losable, and it kind of looks creepy in my drawer. I mean, I could collect them all into a bracelet. I don't know. That's kind of weird. Anyway, now time for my interview with Kit Duvall. Welcome to the podcast, Kit Duvall. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And it's great to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Kit, you are a writer who writes a lot about family, you know, sort of found family and inherited families and adopted families and all the rest of it. And this is something that has come up in your work time and again. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about where that's come from and why you think that these themes seem to crop up in your work quite a lot.
I think mainly because I grew up in the 60s. So I was born in 1960. My sister was born in 58. And then I've got 3 other siblings born within a very, very short time. And we were mixed race. And it's impossible for a lot of people to think about how weird that was in the 60s. So now it's just so normal. But when I was growing up, there were, I mean, I can honestly say there were like two mixed race families in Birmingham because I knew who they were. Do you know what I mean? They were like the Mattisons, the Virtues. You know, you knew the other mixed race families because we all got the same weird looks. So it's really unusual for a white woman to be with a black man. And then on top of that, we were Jehovah's Witnesses. And that made us, again, very different from the mainstream. And also the white in our family was Irish, wasn't English. So that made it difficult again. So there were so many ways that we had to be a tribe. There was no one that we could say, we're like that family, because there was no family that we were like. So consequently, my brothers and sisters, we just became very important to one another. That's not to say we got on all the time, because we didn't and we still don't, but we are the touchstone for normality. It's where I go to if I want to, you know, if I want to feel normal and right and human and that I matter. It's in reference to those people. They, you know, they help me find my way in the universe.
So I've just written this book called Brown Baby, which is this podcast is kind of about. And in that, I talk about having mixed race kids. And that's kind of part of the reason why I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to you, because I know you've got lots to say on this. And I think one of the things that I really wrestle with as a brown father who has two mixed race kids is there is a degree to which they will always either be racialized as brown or as mixed race. And very rarely, if at all, white. And I'm sort of conscious as I raise them that I don't want to kind of belittle or sort of make unimportant the fact that they are half white. But at the same time, because white is a default to an extent, just really making something of the brown side of them is something that's really, really important to me. And it's really interesting that what you said about how you kind of didn't have this was sort of quite atypical for that time in Birmingham. So what was it like for you growing up with that sense of identity?
So well, the school we went to obviously was completely white. I think there was another black family, maybe two towards the end of my junior school. In my senior school, there was me, my sister, and another black girl. Everyone was white, the whole thing. And as I say, we were, our white side was Irish. And, you know, in the 70s, when the IRA were on their bombing campaign, that's not a popular thing to be Irish. It might be all fiddly-dee now and Guinness and Stag Nights in Dublin. But at the time, you know, the Irish were the bad guys. They were the terrorists. They were the what people think of as Muslims today when they categorise terrorists and think they're Muslim and they're bad. That's what Irish was. It was a word, a label that was synonymous with being a terrorist, and that's or stupid. And they usually went hand in hand, you know, the Irish jokes. So that was the Irish side of us. And then the black side of us was, you know, my dad, who was West Indian in the West Indian community, very, very proud black man. And growing up with, and also has to say, both my parents were pretty dysfunctional. So we grew up as I say, in this tribe, and we completely and utterly felt a one thing. I never thought I was half. Yeah, half caste was the phrase in the day, back in the day. I never felt half of anything. I felt double. You know, it was a very, I mean, that's a tribute to my mother, who told us from day one how fantastic it was to be both. Oh my God, you're so fantastic. You're so beautiful. You're so clever. You're so fantastic. Everyone wants to be brown and you're brown already. So she loaded all this stuff onto us that we bought wholesale. So we always thought, wow, it's great to be us. Down really to my mother's upbringing, but also because we felt three things. We felt Irish completely, we felt black completely, we also felt British. You know, we did, you know, brought up in Birmingham in you know, on the outskirts of a very, very middle class area. And so we were just like, yeah man, we can move, we can flex, we can go there, we can go there. I know how to talk that, I know how to eat that, I know where to sit for this. I know how to speak to that, to black Nana, as we called her. And I know how to speak to white Nana. I can do all those things. So for me, I never felt fractured. I never felt less than. I felt I had this sort of chameleon-like ability to know these communities from the inside, from the soft underbelly of these communities. And I felt very, I mean, I didn't know that when I was growing up. Of course, I didn't, I wasn't aware of that. It's only when I get older and people, my white grandmother said to my mother when she was having children for a black man, they're neither fish nor fowl. They won't know where they stand in the world. And I'd be like, what is she talking about? You know, I never internalised that bullshit. But I do know that that isn't the same for a lot of people growing up who struggle to feel wholly in one community or the other. And I think we were very, very lucky that we had such a different experience of thinking we are basically the dog's bollock.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I think you hear so many stories of people from mixed race backgrounds feeling like they have to choose or make a choice. And I guess what you're describing is, I guess this idea of code switching, which, you know, we all do to varying degrees in this country, whether it be along class lines or race lines or, you know, somewhere in between those two things. But this ability for you to just be your true self, with, no matter what environment you were in, but be able to speak or switch into that code, if that makes sense. I don't know.
No, I think that's very true, and I don't think you realise what a skill it is and how it prepares you for the code switching you're going to do for the rest of your life, because we all do it. If you've got any sort of emotional intelligence at all, you'll know that you have to do how to behave in certain circumstances. And I certainly learnt that, you know, from the cradle in many ways. And it's a great skill to have. At the same time, you know, you don't want to be a hypocrite and you don't want that chameleon-like quality to mess you up, you know, to make you look duplicitous or like you're not really black. Because there are, you know, I can remember being 14 and first, you know, discovering boys and going out with boys and, you know, getting a lot of hatred sometimes from certain black areas, you know, like, oh, she thinks she's nice, she's too red, she's a red-skinned bitch. And I was amazed that that would ever come from the black community. Obviously, you expect it from certain areas of the white community. And for me, certainly now, right at the other end of my life, I feel the problem that people have, if you can call it a problem with being mixed race, is their problem. You know, I'm so wholly me and so fine, you know, and I feel like all these different ways that I am in different communities, and there's no doubt that I am, are just like, you know, facets of a diamond. You know, shines this way, that one's a bit dull, turn it that way, that one's shiny, the other side's dull. I just think it's a great thing, but I don't think it's an automatic thing either. I was lucky enough to grow up in Birmingham, super, you know, liberal, middle class area, very, very accepting of difference. Had I been brought up, you know, in an extremely white area where my blackness may not have been such, you know, so accepted, I'm sure I'd feel very different.
Yeah, there's that Zora Neale Hurston quote, I feel most coloured when thrown against a sharp white background. Has that way that you were raised, has that kind of given you any insight into, you know, ways that we can think about raising mixed race children so that they don't feel a lot of this pressure that, you know, to belong to one or the other, and but at the same time have another identity that is very equal but still separate in a way?
I think it's so great for mixed race children now in that there are so many role models. There were no mixed race role models when I was growing up, none. There were black role models, obviously. And I can remember my dad would, you know, if there was a black person on the telly that wasn't Trevor McDonald, he'd go, come down, and it would rush into the telly room, and it'd be like, black person on the telly, oh my God, how great is that? You know, so amazing. But there was never a mixed race. There might be a light-skinned black person, wasn't mixed race, it was very different.
Sorry to interrupt, but it's so funny to think that even in terms of, you know, South Asians, two of the most famous people in the 80s when I was growing up were mixed race, but it wasn't really talked about, Sir Ben Kingsley and Freddie Mercury. And it's like they made a choice to pass as white, which I think is really interesting.
Well, that's a whole other thing, that, you know, the notion of passing, which was really, really interestingly written about by Philip Roth when he wrote Human Stain. Fascinating book about this, you know, this mixed, black guy, in fact, black guy, not even mixed race, who could pass as white and how he lived his life. And I recommend anyone that's interested in that subject, read the book, it's great. I've got two children, they're both mixed race, they're both adopted, they're both different mixed race heritage to me, completely different. Obviously, they're completely unrelated to me. But funnily enough, we did, for my son's 18th, we did the DNA test. And we all did it. So, you know, we knew we were completely unrelated, but we just thought, let's do it anyway. And it turns out the three of us, our blackness, because we're all black in a different way, all comes from Benin in Africa. So we've decided we are related after all, which is fantastic and such a nice thing to find out. But my son in particular, when I adopted him, he was a little boy, and he's peroxide white hair, bright blue eyes and white skin. And he's mixed race. He's got black heritage. And I cannot tell you how many times I was assumed to be his nanny, numerous times. I was his nanny, or I was his childminder. Once I had the police come to the door because it had been reported, and they'd taken down my car registration number, that there was a black person abusing a white child in a car, because I was probably telling him off. I hadn't hit him, but and that was reported to the police as being cause for concern, because you've got this black ogre and this little white precious baby Jesus, and you know the power dynamics was disturbing some of the neighbours. Anyway, so the notion of passing is really interesting, because he can pass completely, and so can my daughter, completely pass as black. And when he was growing up, I used to say, you know you're black, don't you? So I'm not black, Mum, I'm not black. I said, you're black in your heart. You know, because I wanted him to understand his blackness, which he struggled with, obviously. I say, you're mixed race like me. Your skin's come out white, but you've got blackness in your heart. You've got blackness in your soul. And we have great discussions about it even now. And he can choose, and he will be able to choose for the rest of his life, whether or not to identify with black people. You know, and so will my daughter, who's also Native American. And she will be able to decide, you know, that's something I've never had. I don't know what that must be like, to decide to identify with an oppressed people or not. You know, obviously, Luke's extremely proud of being of his black heritage, but wow, that is a thing. You know, you've got to be sorted out and certain and politically astute and proud and knowledgeable and all those things to decide to identify as black in sometimes in difficult circumstances. And I'm, you know, really proud of my children that they do and they can. But it's something I'll never know. I think that might be a challenge, especially for children.
Yeah, God, that's really fascinating. This sort of idea that you can either choose to identify with what is considered in the West to be the default, or to be other.
Yeah, and to have an easier ride. You know, I don't say I'm black, and I will have an easier ride. I mean, that's white privilege in action. Or I can declare who I am, you know, what my heritage is, identify as black or mixed race or whatever, and perhaps have a different experience, whatever that experience is.
Talking about growing up in Birmingham in the 60s, part of two very, very marginalised communities. And when you think back to that time and you think about now, what do you think culturally has sort of changed or hasn't changed for those communities?
I would have to say it's better. It's not there, not by a million miles, but it's better in that there are role models. There are black men and women who have achieved and who are present in our lives on television, in sport, in politics, in business, in every walk of life. There are black men and women, there are mixed race men and women out there that we can look at and say, okay, I can do that. Someone's gone before me. Excuse me about the pinging. In that respect, it's better that there are role models. It is now, I mean, I would say officially in young circles, cool to be black. It was not cool to be black when I was young at all. There was Michael Jackson, that was it. So I think now it is cool to be black. It's cool to know the language. Black music, black popular culture is basically mimicked by everybody, you know, these days for young people. So in many ways, it's better. I think in the way that it's worse is, hey ho, here we are still talking about it. Why do we have to talk about it? Why are statues still be pulled down? Why are black people, why is there a Black Lives Matter thing even at all considered? Why haven't we solved it? And I'm tired, you know, I'm tired of talking about race. Like lots and lots of people are tired of talking about it. This initiative, that initiative, that's, yeah, we're going to do it this time. In those ways, it's worse because we've tried and failed. Well, we haven't tried and failed, but things have been tried and things have failed. So in that way, I think there's so much work to be done. However, it is, I can see from my children who are 25 and 20, they live in a different world, certainly as regards race. You know, for a start, there's legislation. The first race relations legislation in this country came out in 1973. Pre-1973, you know, my mother was spat at many times for having black children. My parents couldn't buy a house because my father was black. That's all changed. There's legislation now to protect certain behaviours and certain systems. Great that we've got the legislation. What a shame that we have to have the legislation still and that we haven't got to this place of true equality and true acceptance. We still have a massive gap in the payment for ethnic minorities. There's still not enough people from ethnic minority backgrounds in real positions of power, real positions of power, not perceived positions of power. We still have massive inequalities in every single measurement, like housing, life chances, health, as we know from COVID. So, you know, there's still massive inequalities, but I would rather my children grew up in this world of race equality than in my world of race equality, definitely.
When I did The Good Immigrant in 2016, 2017, I just found myself kind of at the forefront of a lot of these conversations, almost by accident, even though I just wanted to write fiction. And I was talking to my uncle. So my uncle came over to the UK in the 60s, and in 1968, he tried to buy a house, and they refused to sell it to him because there was a company policy not to sell to coloured people. The Race Relations Act had just come in. And so my uncle took them to court, and he was the first person to ever bring a case of racial discrimination under the 1968 Race Relations Act. And because it was a test case, it was actually dismissed by the judge. But in dismissing the case, the judge had said that had he tried it, he would have found in favor of my uncle because discrimination had taken place. And the company was so shamed by this that they actually changed their policy, which was just this brilliant encapsulation that, like, one person can make a difference if the difference that they want to make is achievable and manageable. And I remember talking to my uncle about this around the time of The Good Immigrant, because he was immensely proud of, like, the work that I was doing. And one of the things that he said was, after Brexit, he sort of started to see that there were conversations still happening that he had fought for 50 years ago, because it was such a huge thing for him to bring this thing to court. He went against everyone to do this thing. Like, my family was saying don't do this, his friends and all the rest of it. And he said 50 years later and we're still having the same conversations. And he said, you know, they keep telling us that the laws have made us more equal. And yes, there are laws in place that make us more equal. But what work has been done in this country for people's hearts and minds? And I thought that was a really interesting concept. The thing that I realized in that moment was that you and me, Kit, our work as writers who dabble in activism, well, not dabble, but writers who do activism work, we are doing that work to change people's hearts and minds. And so I suddenly in that moment realized my responsibility as a writer. It was really, really powerful.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
One of the things I just completely admire about you is, as a writer, you know, you're putting out amazing work, but at the same time, you're setting up scholarships and you're widening the conversation around diversity to ensure that we're also talking about class. And, you know, the project that you did with the Common People Project, like what you did for unpublished working class writers was like leagues beyond what I'd managed to do with The Good Immigrant. And I just think that I see that in you, like there's just something within you that wants to do that work and wants to change those hearts and minds.
Thanks for saying that, but I do feel very much, as you said, dabbling in activism, and I feel like, you know, I'm the reluctant activist because I never wanted to do this. You know, I never wanted to be anyone's spokesman. I never wanted to be the, you know, oh, she's got something to say. I just wanted to, like you, just want to write my books, and you know, if I can just write my books and just do that, that's fine. I do also feel, and I don't want to put this on other people because I don't think it's everyone's responsibility to speak out. Some, you know, if you've got a big mouth, it's quite easy to speak out. I feel I've got something to say and I'm quite happy to say it and take the knocks. Not everyone feels like that. And I think we can't load that responsibility onto everybody. I feel if I can, I should. That's my journey. And some people can't or don't want to. And just want to have a quiet life. And you don't know what people live with and what trauma they have and what their views are. So I don't put it on everybody. But I do feel, for me, a lot to do with my children, you know, the journey my children have had, which hasn't been an easy journey through life, and the journey that they will have. I feel not duty bound, because I do loathe that word, but I feel a responsibility to point out things that are wrong, especially where equality is concerned, and bringing people to the point where they feel they've got a fair crack of the whip. And if they don't want to take avail themselves of that opportunity, that's fine. But at least have the opportunity there. You might not want to do anything with it, but have the freedom to express yourself. And certainly as regards, you know, a fairer society for my children and for their children, it's so important to me that they don't suffer some of the same shit I had. Massively important. So I'm, you know, I probably went slightly too far when they were at school, because if they had any shit whatsoever, I was up there, you know, I was just like, you know, not having it at all. Anything the teacher said that was remotely exclusionary against children in care or you know, black children or whatever it was that I was, you know, they'd been discriminated against, I would be there. To the point where the children say, don't go to school, Mom. I'm just going to tell you something that happened at school, but I don't want you to do anything about it because I'd be too interventionist. So I think there's, you know, for those of us that see things that are wrong and we have a desire to change the world or we want to see a different world, I think it is true that you have to be the change that you want to see. You know, if you see something and it's within your ability and your personality to do something about it, then try and change the world so that, you know, my children don't have the same bollocks that I had at school, and they also are being brought into a world that's equal in so many ways. You know, I remember saying to my daughter when she was about 15, she had this really close best friend, and I said, you know, are you gay, Beth? Are you lesbian? And she said, no, Mom. I said, you know, you can be, you know, and I start on this flipping tirade where I'm more or less telling her she is, and she's going, Mom, I'm not gay, okay? And I say, well, you can be and you might be, and don't close the door on it, because you could like girls this week and boys next week, or you might like, and I'm going over the top. And she said to me recently, she said, God, Mom, you used to really annoy me trying to make me gay. And I wasn't trying to make her gay. I was trying to go the other way to the world I'd had, where that would have been a cause of shame. That would have been a cause of embarrassment. I wanted her to have the world in front of her and to be able to express herself in whatever way she wanted. Obviously, I was over the top about it and got it wrong. But, you know, it came from me wanting her to have this expansive, anything goes, wonderful opportunity to be herself. And I still feel, you know, very much feel like that.
I do sometimes wonder if sometimes as parents we tend to go for the opposite of the things we perceive to not be great about how we were raised. And so if you were surrounded by closed doors, you'll keep the doors as open as possible, but sometimes that means that you know, you forget that kids do need parameters and boundaries to operate within.
Yes, you do. You do, definitely. And I think, you know, I was certainly being brought up in an extremely fundamentalist Christian religion that was very damaging. I definitely went over the top in saying to my children, you know, you can do what you want. You don't have to listen to authority. If a teacher does that, tell them to piss off. You know, I was way wrong. I was wrong. I remember being in town with my son once, and there was a man walked past us and he had green hair and no shoes on, and my kids are going, oh, look at that man with green hair. I was going, so what, he looks fantastic. Do you know what he's doing? He's expressing myself. And I give them this very long over the top speech, because the guy did look weird, let's face it. So my children are just, they're not laughing, you know, in any nasty way, but they've never seen anything like it. And I was really just, instead of going, yes, doesn't he look funny, but isn't it great? I just get onto my soapbox and I'm laying into the kids saying, never laugh at people that are different. That's my crap. Do you know what I mean? That's just as bad, that kind of parenting, as the person that, you know, as my mother, who would have thought that was the worst thing in the world. So I think, you know, I mean, I'm pretty immature as parents go. So I'm still working on being a grown up with my children.
One of the things that's so great about your career is you've been writing for years and years and years, but 3 or 4 years ago you were able to kind of make a complete career transition and become a full-time writer, and I wonder if that's something that you would have felt like you could have done when you
were younger. I didn't want to be a writer. I didn't think about being
a
writer until I was in my early 40s. I adopted Luke in 1980,
or whether they even entered,
and he was quite ill, and so I gave up work and I had to be at home, bored out of my skull, it has to be said. I started work when I was 16, I think. And I had worked all that time until I found myself sort of 44, thinking, oh my God, I cannot paint the kitchen again. You know, I've got to find something else to do with my life. So started writing and found it incredibly hard, but I absolutely fell in love with it. And it really was a sort of response to having time and space to think. I think maybe had I had time and space earlier on, I would have started, but I didn't have any time. I was bringing up children, I was running a house, I was working, and all of a sudden I found myself, didn't have to work, couldn't work, had these long days, sometimes long nights, and that's when I started to write. And I think for a lot of working class people, we do come to writing later in life. You might have paid off some of the bills, you might have got yourself a fridge, freezer and a car, and you don't need to work so hard to get them or whatever. And also there's that great sense of time running out, if not now, when? So when I started writing, it was a revelation to me that I could want something so badly. Before this, I had worked to earn money. You know, that was my job. 5 o'clock, pen drop, I'm gone. And all of a sudden, here was I working for no money, writing, trying to get better, working all these hours at this craft that I you know, completely got to me. And I discovered for the first time in my life what ambition was. I'd never understood it before. And I was really ambitious. You know, I wanted to get published. I wanted to work out how to get to be a better writer and how to do all these things. So in many ways, it was great that it didn't come to me earlier. I don't think I'd have been as good. I don't think I'd have been compassionate at all. I was too angry.
That ambition thing, I think, is fascinating, because it's something that writers are very loath to admit that they feel. And I definitely would never shy away from admitting that I'm ambitious. But given that the publishing industry is such an opaque industry, it really doesn't know how to do PR on itself. How did you go about discovering how it works?
I had no idea. I can remember when, I didn't know you needed an agent. No one told, I never heard of an agent. I thought you wrote your book, you sent it to Penguin, because they're the only people I knew. They put a wrapper on it, and 6 weeks later, it's on the 3 for 2 thing in Waterstones. That's how it works, surely. I had no idea. And I was 50 at this time. I'm 50 when that's what I think about the publishing industry. I had no idea. And so when I got an agent, and she, you know, my book went to auction and it was a big deal. And they said, oh, you know, yeah, we'll do some editing. And I was like, whoa, What do you mean, editing? I've written the book. I didn't know you had an editor. Didn't know you had a proofreader. I just didn't know. You know, it took me... When I just got published... maybe 3 months after I got published, I got an interview with the... I was asked to do an interview with the Guardian. And I was talking to this journalist and just answering these questions. And I said, you know, and where are all the working class writers? And I really meant... I know it seems like it's a condemnatory question. I was being really serious. Where are they all? Introduce me to them. I was thinking, they must be there somewhere, but where are they? And from that point onwards... I started to look at the industry in a much more interrogative way where, oh, where's that? And how does that happen? And, you know, it was a very, very slow route into activism and slow route into knowing how the industry is set up and this concentration of the industry in London and lots of exclusionary systems and practices. You know, it was like a year-long masterclass in how the publishing industry works. It was no slow... realization. And I'm massively new into publishing. I'm massively new into this. You know, my book got published 4 years ago. There's still lots I don't know. There are people that have been working in publishing for 20 or 30 years that know it inside out. I am completely still the new girl in this industry.
But I think that idea of being new is important because it forces the industry to assess how approachable and accessible it is, which is something that you have shown time and time again. It can be more accessible if we just think about accessibility.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, sometimes there are tweaks that you can do, lots of tweaks that you can do. And one of the things, you know, if there's any good thing about COVID, it's that all of a sudden people have realised you can do a lot of these meetings, you know, by Zoom, virtually, because... you would have a situation, you still have a situation where an agent will speak, you know, let's say you've sent off your manuscript, you live in Doncaster, you've sent your manuscript off to London, and the agent will say, yeah, come and see me on Thursday at 4 o'clock. And you're like, wow, really? So that's, what, £160 on the train, get across London, some childcare, sandwich, coffee, a lot of money. But that sentence, come and see me on Thursday, is... a really great invitation. No one's going to turn it down. But actually, let's unpick what that means for someone. And if anything good's come out of COVID, it's the fact that people now would say, let's Zoom so I can talk to you about that. Because that was not on the table before. You would never have said, I can't come and see you on Thursday because I can't afford £200. You'd have just found the £200 and you'd have gone because this is your big opportunity. Now I think the industry is coming alive to the fact that we can do some of these things, these important things, important meetings, virtually, which saves time and makes things slightly more equal. It's not to say there's not digital poverty, but I'm not going to get into that one. So I think, you know, the industry, that's just a tiny tweak. That's a tiny, tiny tweak that the industry can make that equals things out. And then there are huge systemic things that need to change.
Yeah, God, he used to bore my piss when, you know, I'd have, you know, because I also don't live in London, when I'd have to drop a day's work in order to come in for a 30-minute meeting that could have been done over the phone. I'm talking specifically about working in TV, where you go in and pitch a bunch of ideas and it's the vibes in the room that might lead to something 3 years from now, maybe. I don't know. I remember you telling me over a cup of tea once, we were talking about writing and balancing writing with kids because I had a new baby at the time, and you told me that you were a night owl and that you can't write before like 10 o'clock at night. Is that still the case? And is that something that kind of came out of being a parent and working?
No, just came out of being a night person. You know, I'm just shit up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon on anything, doesn't matter what it is. Particularly writing, I find I can edit in the day, I can do editing all day long. But the creative work, when I can access whatever it is you access as a writer to do your best work, I can only do when the world's gone quiet. I have to have a sort of vroom, like someone's got the big lever and they've pulled it down and everything's just gone from 11 to 2. Then I can sort of tune in. I feel like there's less noise in my head and there's just less noise in the world. It's like I can access it on the quiet because you're not looking now, you're trying to sleep. I don't know. I mean, that's a really shit way of explaining it, but I really cannot write. I mean, it wouldn't be 10. The earliest, I suppose, would be 9. 8 or 9, and then I might work till 4 in the morning, something like that.
Yeah, I can't do it anymore. I guess my biggest fear as a parent at the moment is being someone who is, I guess, for all intents and purposes, part of the culture war and, you know, very politically minded and, you know, obsessed with the news and worrying about the news. I want to raise my kids in a world where they are prepared and realistic about what the world looks like, but I'm still instilling them with a sense of boundlessness and joy. And I know that they are a lot younger than your kids are, but how do you retain a sense of joy and wonder with your kids when things seem as bleak and as dark as they are, or as uncertain as they are?
The only thing I think, and this is a fallback to my mother, you know, one of the, I wouldn't say the few things she got right, but she certainly got this right. She told us we were wonderful. So I'm not really one for joy and boundless energy, and isn't nature great? It's just not me. I'm not going to do that. What I would do, and I think, oh, well, I know what I did for my children, is like, you are so great. You're so great. You know, you've done that so great. You're not, you know, sometimes my daughter particularly had a hard time at school, and she'd come home and she'd say, oh, was that happen? I'd go, who was it? And she'd say, oh, you know, Linda Jones. I go, Linda Jones with the bad hair, you know, and we'd be just laughing about Linda Jones. And, you know, apart from taking it seriously, it was also, you are so great. You know, that's just what I gave them, and they believe it. It's not belief. No, they know it. They know they're great. And of course, you know, there's loads of limitations on what they can do. They have had a difficult start in life. They will continue to be challenged throughout their life. But inside, at your core, at the place that is the most precious and the most important, you are great. I am great. And that's what my children would say and know, I hope.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kit DeWaal.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It goes without saying that I'd love it if you subscribed to this podcast and left a great review and told all your social medias about us and supported the book. Yes, please, please buy the book anywhere you want. I'm not going to judge where you buy your books. That's not for me to judge. I don't know you. You don't know me. Hard sell, etc., etc. Brown Baby, available in all good bookshops and some bad bookshops and some mediocre bookshops. Thank you for joining us. I'll see you next week. Thank you to Acast for supporting the podcast and to my publishers, Bluebird, and to Kit, who took time out from a ridiculous deadline to speak to me, and to you for listening. Bye.
Brown baby, I am brown baby. Yes, I am, I am. Silly brown baby.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.